From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, why there's a lot at stake from redeveloping the Milwaukee neighborhood of Westlawn Gardens.
This is the largest public housing site in the state of Wisconsin. And so transforming that makes a difference not just for the residents there, but again, the larger neighborhood and really the city at large.
Then as Blade Runner 2049 opens in theaters around the country, it's inevitable there are comparisons to the 1982 original. And it's also inevitable that not all those comparisons are favorable.
One of the things about the original movie was that it left a number of things unclear. The remake seems to want to try to solve those questions, and some people I know have objected to this. It spoiled everything. Now, I would rather have just left it to my imagination.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Low-income public housing projects used to be thought of as islands, often cut off from the rest of city life. They were densely populated, often high-rise apartment complexes which were troubled by gangs, drugs, and other crime activity. But over the last decade or two, public housing design has shifted. High-rises are giving way to a more neighborhood-based approach.
Case in point is the 65-year-old Westlawn Gardens on Milwaukee's northwest side, where work is proceeding on a mixed-income development that features not only living space, but is being developed in partnership with area businesses and education leaders. Murphy Antoine is one of the people shaping the new direction of Westlawn. He is an architect and planner with a Maryland-based firm, Torti Gallus & Partners. Warren Jones is vice president of construction for Milwaukee's Travaux Incorporated. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you for having us.
So what have the fundamental problems with how cities have approached public housing been in the past?
Well, I think there was a really kind of post-war, post-World War II attitude towards public housing and towards a lot of suburban housing, frankly, where it was a monoculture. It was all really one thing. So as that played out at Westlawn and in lots of cities across the nation, it was really one thing: concentrated poverty. All the very low-income people are going to be in this place. It was thought of very well-intended as perhaps temporary solution. But it was, you know, you put all of one thing in one place and it can lead to problems.
Much of the public housing was built in what are called super blocks. And, you know, they're really not usable for traversing from non-public housing environments and neighborhoods. So Westlawn in particular was a 75-acre site that was built in the 52 to 54 and, 726 units of public housing in a kind of a mishmash of barrack-style buildings. Not much definition of public, private, and semi-private spaces, and really a poor design for what we consider good planning today.
It sounds like, maybe to oversimplify things, these places, and Westlawn in particular, were really not a holistic part of a city.
Right, and ignored a lot of the lessons of the fabric of the city, and really stuck out, and again, in ways that you would see all over the country. You could drive by it and you knew what it was. You knew it was public housing, and it feels very different than, you know, a neighborhood. Then we were talking about Yankee Hill earlier or River West. So there are models throughout Milwaukee and throughout every town that you can just look back to and try to figure out what works there and maybe what could be applied in something, a transformation.
Aside from the aesthetics, what's wrong with the separateness idea?
Well, number one, you don't want this monoculture, if you will, of all one strata of income or one strata of anything, really. And that's really what it was. And as Murphy said earlier, it was a concentration of poverty. And, you know, the folks that lived there, you know, the kids that were growing up in the developments really didn't have a chance to see other people that were successful, had jobs to go to, and from an economic standpoint, it really didn't promote upward mobility.
And I think that plays through in all of its kind of social implications, which we try to work through from a physical standpoint. But we, as architects and planners, sort of think of what are the physical things that you can do and to play off of some of those challenges. Again, the super blocks that are not connected, the inability to define what's public space and what's private space. So where's my front yard? Where's my backyard? And if I don't know where it is and you don't know where it is, then maybe I can hang out on your stoop. Maybe I can hang out on your back stoop. Maybe I can hide in the corners in the back because there's not a street there. So all of those things, I think, played together to cause some challenges.
And at the same time, I gather the economics of it were fairly easy. I mean, these were not necessarily expensive things to build when you design something simply like that. I mean, was that one of the key definers of why things had always looked like that, just because they were cheap?
I think that's a good assumption. And cheap is a relative term. I mean, they were brick homes. They had wood floors. So things that nowadays are deemed as, desired amenities, if you will, were included. However, the execution of those, the size of the units, 400 square feet for a one-bedroom place. It's not a typical modern living situation. But I think that the idea that repetition is inexpensive, and that's what we have at most of the public housing developments, is a repetitive design and repetitive use of space.
And repetitive housing type. So they don't just look the same from the outside. They're largely the same from the inside.
Right.
And we know that families aren't all the same. You have older single people. You have large families. And so that's been a real key to the transformation at Westlawn as well, that there's a much larger variety of housing types to meet a much larger variety of housing needs.
Well, and so I gather the changes at Westlawn and in other neighborhoods around the country are very much in keeping with the idea of new urbanism?
Absolutely, which does go and look at the old urbanism. So part of the charrette, the design process, us being from Silver Spring or Washington, D.C., and not knowing Milwaukee as well as the housing authority, as well as the residents, we walk around those neighborhoods, the old urbanism, see the great neighborhoods and what are the patterns that make Milwaukee distinct and give people really the pride of place of those neighborhoods, and how can we transfer those lessons to start to transform the northwest corner of the city around Westlawn Gardens.
Right. I gather, I mean, the whole thing about new urbanism is when it looks, the old urbanism wasn't necessarily constructed with a name in mind. It was just, this is the way cities were built.
Right. And so I think, the new urbanism is something that's been around for about 25 years or so, really is, think about it as connected, walkable places where you can live in your house, be proud of your house, but also walk to the corner store, walk to school, walk to get to the places that you live your life, and it's really again developing from with those patterns and connections in mind.
Well, so then let's talk about the Choice Neighborhood Initiative and how this new urbanism and this new thought about design when it comes to public housing and neighborhoods is playing out in Westlawn Gardens.
So Choice Neighborhoods is a federal program through HUD that really looks at that kind of transformation and looks at some of these lessons going back to the 90s and the transformations and what we could do better. And it really is about a bigger, broader horizon. So the Housing Authority has a housing focus and a housing mission, as it should. But we know that that's not the only part of a neighborhood. So Choice Neighborhood says, what can we do? What can we look at beyond the boundaries of that project? So looking across Silver Spring to improving the retail, making connections with MPS and education as a component, economic development and family self-sufficiency. So it's not just about the sticks and bricks of the house or the block. It's making broader geographic connections and kind of broader social connections.
And Choice Neighborhood is really a successor to the Hope 6 program, which was really focused in on the revitalization of public housing. So as Murphy said, it's really an expansion of something that we're very familiar with. We've had six Hope Sixes in Milwaukee, and we were very fortunate to get the Choice Neighborhoods Initiative Award.
Can you give us a picture of what this looks like besides just, you know, the you know, square footage of each particular unit?
Well, one of the housing authority's goals from the very beginning was to make this a very sustainable neighborhood, to make this as green as possible and from every aspect. And I think Westlawn Gardens in a lot of ways leads even market rate development in that aspect. It's highly energy efficient from the insulation ratings of roofs and walls to the systems that go into them. The apartment buildings have a geothermal heating and cooling system. So we're keeping energy bills down for the long term, for the life cycle of the buildings. And we're also addressing the sustainability, the greenness through many other healthy aspects. So reducing incidents of childhood and elderly asthma through addressing mold and healthy air and cleaning ducts, even to the point of specifying low pollinating plants. And there was a lot of a thought and detail that went into those aspects that really contribute to making it a neighborhood, making it a place where people want to live and keeping it affordable.
Yeah. And when Westlawn, we started in 2009, we were actually the highest rated lead neighborhood development in the world. That's something that is an accolade, but it's also in practice a very, very positive result for the neighborhood. We tried to do a holistic approach. We created walking spaces, pedestrian-friendly areas, so that not only did the folks have a place to live that's healthy, they have a place to inhabit as far as walking, parks. There's a jogging path. Many different things that will affect their well-being.
A new playground that the Bucks contributed to that stands on top of a lot of the stormwater efficiency. One of the partnerships with Growing Power, there's an over a 2-acre community garden there that the residents participate in and make that partnership with Growing Power. So a lot of great things happening out at Westlawn Gardens.
How are you able to do this in such a way that, you know, your impact extends beyond just the boundaries of Westlawn Gardens into the adjacent neighborhood?
Partnerships. Really getting people that are key stakeholders of the neighborhood together and planning out a successful revitalization of Westlawn, as well as getting the neighborhood involved. You know, some of the partners, Havenswood Business District, MPS, all of the folks that really need to come together to bring business, education, social services, as well as the bricks and sticks portion of it.
The city, the state, the Bucks, you know, I would even go beyond that. I think partnerships is exactly the right word, but it's also building on the success. Warren mentioned the previous Hope Sixes that the Housing Authority had completed and done well, and success attracts other success, and people want, you know, see that success. And they're more willing to be part of it. So I think it's a real credit to the city and the Housing Authority that they've been able to attract those partners and those strong partnerships, because there's a track record there.
How do you take on such large-scale projects like this without turning a positive into a negative? I mean, the idea that what you're planning is better than what was there before, but to get there, there's going to be this disruption and this potential uprooting of people.
It really is a matter of letting people know what's going to happen and getting them involved from the very beginning, not springing something on them that they don't know about. And, you know, Murphy and his team did a great job. There was a 4-day charrette or planning session where all parties were invited to the table to discuss what was needed, what was wanted, how people felt about their neighborhood. And it was, you know, it really, as long as people know what's coming, they can prepare for it. If you spring something on it that on them that they don't expect, that's really a precursor for failure.
And again, these things don't happen quickly, so there is the time available to get the word out. And I do think that that's the key. You have to do it in communication. You have to do it with the neighbors, with the stakeholders, and on their turf, right? We're not doing it back in the Hackam offices. We're not doing it back in an architecture office. We're doing it in the cafeteria at Browning Elementary and letting people come by anytime they want to see what's going on.
Well, what's the status of the West Lawn project?
Well, we're in the process of the second phase of demolition right now. We have 22 families left out of the original 394 on the west side. The construction for Victory Manor, which is a veterans preference apartment building, will be started next month. And we also have 30 townhomes that are being built on the east side between 60th and 64th that are part of the next phase, if you will.
Is there something really, fundamental, I guess, about talking about these places as neighborhoods rather than public housing projects?
It's key. When you speak of a project, there's some pejorative negativity that goes along with that. And they aren't projects. They're neighborhoods, just like any other neighborhood. Development of market rate apartments is no different than the development of affordable apartments. And, the stigma that's associated with the term projects is really something that, it doesn't need to be there.
And in fact, they're mixed in, right? So the transformation is from all concentrated, very low income to mixed income. So those market rate apartments and houses and home ownership opportunities are mixed into the fabric of the transformation, just like any other neighborhood would be. And it's about the choice that you want people to have, the kind of housing choices that we would all want, and not just for very low income people, which are the drivers for the transformation, but also for workforce housing. Where do the teachers live? Where do the emergency services professionals live?
Yeah. Not everybody can afford $2,800 a month for an apartment. And the idea that affordable housing necessarily translates to low-income housing is really something that's kind of antiquated thinking, because many people of different income strata are eligible for affordable housing as opposed to low income.
From a personal standpoint, from the standpoint of an architect, is there something especially fulfilling about being able to take on a project like this?
A couple things, and I'll go back to something Warren mentioned, is the partnerships. Like, everybody has a commitment on West Lawn. Everybody is holding up their end and doing the work at the highest level of their expertise. So that is a wonderful thing to be part of. And there are challenges on every project, but when you've got a strong team working together, that makes all the difference. And the scale. This is the largest public housing site in the state of Wisconsin. And so transforming that makes a difference, not just for the residents there, but again, the larger neighborhood and really the city at large. So it's great to be a part of that.
And I'm not an architect, but an engineer. And from an engineering perspective, the idea that we are helping MMSD treat the water with our bioswales and our different types of rain gardens, keeping combined sewer overflows and sanitary sewer overflows out of Lake Michigan is just, something that is very important and gives a very positive feeling to me.
Well, it's important work. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about West Lawn.
Murphy Antoine is an architect with the Maryland-based firm Torti Gallus & Partners. Warren Jones is vice president of construction for Milwaukee's Trevo Incorporated. Both are involved in the redevelopment of Milwaukee's West Lawn Gardens.
We'll talk about the latest edition of Blade Runner 2049, and how it compares to the original when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
We'll be right back.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. When Ridley Scott's Blade Runner hit theaters in 1982, its shocking dystopian future world alienated audiences. It didn't do well at the box office and only later became a cult favorite.
She's a replicant, isn't she?
I'm impressed. How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
It took more than 100 for Rachel, didn't it?
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto. Rachel is an experiment, nothing more.
We began to recognize in them strange obsession. After all, they are emotionally inexperienced with only a few years in which to store up the experiences which you and I take for granted. If we gift them the past, we create a cushion or pillow for their emotions, and consequently, we can control them better.
Memories. You're talking about memories.
Skip forward to 2017 and Blade Runner 2049. This long-awaited sequel expands the L.A. of the original and also expands upon the basic question of the original film, what does it mean to be human?
Critic Dave Lurson spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. He has mixed feelings about the film and began with an excerpt from his Shepherd Express review.
The Los Angeles of Blade Runner 24 is a more dismal place than the 2019 L.A. of the original film, and the problems aren't confined to one decaying city. In the 30 preceding years, the blackout took down the World Wide Web. After the global ecosystem collapsed in the 2020s, the Wallace Corporation kept the Earth fed through synthetic farming. Wallace also bought the patents for those synthetic people called replicants and upgraded the design. The newer models ostensibly lack the spark of free will that caused so much trouble 30 years before.
Blade Runner 2049. So I'm curious, were you skeptical going into seeing this new film, or did its director and executive producer, Ridley Scott, give you some faith and comfort in the quality?
Well, some faith and comfort, and yet at the same time, as interesting as the movie is, it, I think, faltered after a certain point. To me, what happened was that the director, Denis Villeneuve, who did this excellent, very modestly budgeted science fiction film called Arrival, which I think we even talked about at the time. The movie stirred a buzz. He got called to Hollywood and was given a huge budget and a mediocre screenplay and was set to work on this. I think the screenplay is one of the problems. It, you know, it's credited to two people, and whenever you see a name on a screenplay, you can multiply by three the number of people often who have written it. It looked overwritten. It looked as though parts of the idea got lost along the way. It looked as though the director felt the need to try to incorporate as much of it into the movie as he could. And as a result, the running time went on and on and on. I don't know exactly, you know, what Harrison Ford's, you know, production relationship was with the film. I suppose, in a way, keeping him, you know, out of the picture until about the two-hour mark or so may have built some suspense. It also may have aggravated some fans of the original movie who would have liked to have seen more of him, maybe. I'm neither here nor there on that point. But basically, you know, I have a feeling that if a movie goes over 2 hours, every minute needs
to
be...
That's like 2 hours 43 or something.
Yeah, that every minute needs to count for something, and I wasn't getting that feeling in watching the film. I think this could have been a really good two-hour movie, but it just got out of hand.
Well, it's interesting how you say this script wasn't as strong when they even got the original Blade Runner screenwriter, Hampton Fancher, and Michael Green was the other credited writer who wrote Logan. And you would think that having the original screenwriter from Blade Runner in 1982 would perhaps keep it on track a little more?
I would think so. And what's good about the screenplay is that it does preserve the concepts and concerns of Philip K. Dick, the author whose remarkable body of work inspired the original Blade Runner in the first place. So you have all the Philip K. Dick elements, you know, mentioned, referenced, or embedded in the screenplay. So what is human? What is not human? Free will versus predestination, the fallibility of memory, you know, on and on, with reality versus illusion. Are we living in a constructed world of some kind? Do we have a limited ability to see what's beyond what's socially constructed around us? All very important themes. And they add some things, too. I mean, the original movie had a doomy vision of the future.
Yes.
And as I was sitting in the movie theater recently watching the new Blade Runner, I couldn't help but thinking of a friend who moved to Marin County, north of San Francisco, many years ago. I had visited him recently, and we were in touch by email that day about the fire not too far, 20 miles away. It's raining ash on his neighborhood. Mm. A wall of smoke on the northern horizon from where he's living. I mean, the movie does, you know, capture the apocalyptic sense of the moment here, where you have a world of one disaster after another. All of this is good, and all of it, I think, could have been condensed into, again, a really excellent two-hour movie. Again, I don't know the production history of this. I have a feeling that there was tampering from one end or another on this, and rewrites, and we need to get this here, we need to put that over there kind of a thing. And I have a feeling that the original concept got a little bit stretched out of shape after a certain point in time.
Right. The director, he is known for being deliberate in his spacing and drawing out these panoramic shots and having a real eye and appreciation for cinematography. But as you said, maybe that could have cut out 10 minutes
right,
or more.
Right. Well, again, visually, it's an impressive movie.
Yeah.
He did a good job, the director, of transposing the original Blade Runner into 30 years on from that point. How would this really dark and unappealing Los Angeles of 2019 look 30 years after that point, when the world went further downhill? So, yeah, I think it's great what he did, especially the hologram advertising, gigantic figures beckoning you to do things as you pass by in your flying car or whatever. It's very immersive in that kind of way. He does create a very palpable sense of a world that we wouldn't, I think, most of us want to live in.
Yeah, and I do think it really captured what the original Blade Runner portrayed so well and, you know, added to it. And one thing that I found interesting with the lead up to this movie is that the director asked other artists to make two short films leading up to it. Did you happen to watch those?
No, I did not. Did you?
Yeah.
Well,
so they're good. There's one anime version because it describes some of the events that they allude to, like the blackout. Another is about Mike Bautista's character in the beginning. One short story is about him and his role in it as well. So in addition to having Blade Runner 2049, we have these little two bits of information leading up to it. So do you think, I mean, with all this prep and lead up to it, would people necessarily even need to watch the original Blade Runner to see and appreciate this? Or does this divide audiences in the way that the original did, and that it didn't do well in the box office in 1982? It was a cult fan favorite. So do you think today that divide still exists, where people who are fans of the original will love it, but then the pacing and construction of the movie might alienate mainstream audiences?
Well, again, I'm a fan of the originals, and I'm kind of mixed in my view of the sequel. So I saw the original at the Oriental Theater when it first came out, and the movie was startling, as was the previous Ridley Scott science fiction film, Alien, for giving us a different way of thinking of what the world would look like in the future. I mean, you think about Star Trek and so many other science fiction productions up until that time, it was a very antiseptic future, everything clean and neat and polished. And Ridley Scott showed a world that was very gritty and grimy, future worlds in many cases. Things were turning out very badly, you know, actually, and in these future worlds, a sense of optimism was not there. And I think that Blade Runner really affected the way that a lot of science fiction films made after that point looked. It represented a kind of change in visual paradigm. So it didn't find a big audience at the time, probably because it was so different than, you know, a Star Trek movie or a Star Wars movie or many of the other kinds of science fiction that existed at that point. So what about mainstream audiences of today? I don't know. Do you need to know the original movie to appreciate this? I don't think so. I think there's enough explanatory information right at the beginning that you can jump right into the storyline. I think that maybe the disadvantage of being familiar with the original movie for some people will be the inevitable problem of comparing it to the original and kind of weighing it in your mind. Did this do justice to the story? One of the things about the original movie was that it left a number of things unclear. The remake seems to want to try to solve those questions, and some people I know have objected to this. It spoiled everything. Now we know this and that. And the other thing, I would rather have just left it to my imagination, some people have said.
Right. Now, outside of the setup and the pacing of the film, I thought the performances themselves were really good. And I was actually impressed with Ryan Gosling and his, you know, I suppose you could say lack of human emotions.
Well,
I don't know if this is a great thing to say for an actor, but he did a really good job as a replicant.
Well, I think Harrison Ford did a great job, you know, too, in the original movie where we didn't quite know where he was coming from or what he was. Yeah, a replicant, you know, again, if you're not familiar with this, I mean, it's a synthetic person, someone who looks like a person, but has a much more limited range of human responses because you're not really supposed to respond, I guess, in quite the same rich way. So again, it seems paradoxical, but maybe that is more challenging for an actor because you have to dial it down. If you imagine what it would be like to have, you know, instead of a full spectrum of responses, half of it maybe or whatever it may be, you can't really cry. Can you get angry even? I don't know. Why would a replicant be? Or show anger. He, in this movie, plays a, as I said before, a new model kind of replicant designed to be even less, have less human. Yeah, more compliant. An entity that is supposed to lack the freedom to even maybe realize what a bad situation he is in. It's a good performance as an entity with limited abilities, you know, and it's harder to do, I suppose, than many people would imagine.
And much like the original, it does center the story around some core characters. It is a bit more number compared to just Harrison Ford and the certain replicants and Rachel in the beginning, but we have Gosling's character, Robin Wright. Harrison Ford comes in later, mm-hmm. you know, tying the connection to all this, but Jared Leto's character of, you know, the latest corporation head and his replicant, his personal replicant. I thought her performance was really well done.
Yes. Jared Leto, I guess playing this sort of mogul guru, kind of a sinister Steve Jobs, Elon Musk or something of this
yes.
kind, who is bent on dominating not only the world, but maybe the whole cosmos. I like the character. I mean, I think it was very effectively done. You know, some of the secondary characters were sort of superficial, but then again, they didn't need to be more than that. So really, my complaint is, why couldn't this have been a two-hour movie? I think mm-hmm. that the pacing would have been much better. It would have been very exciting and held my attention, you know, from one minute to the next. And it just, to me, became interminable after a certain point.
So pacing is the number one issue. What else do you think it lacks compared to what its predecessor accomplished or portrayed? You know, it wasn't quite as noir themed.
You know, again, maybe that was a deliberate aspect of it because, again, how does a made-up society visually change, you know, 30 years on? A lot of the noir aspect of the original Blade Runner was conveyed visually. So the world at that point looked a little bit more like that. And now, 30 years on, it looks less like that. So there was that aspect of it, I think, too, which the director did quite well. In thinking about this movie, it's always, for me, more interesting in a way to think about movies I have mixed responses to than movies I just love it completely or hate entirely. Forces you to think a little bit more about it. And really, I think this movie, the failed aspects of it, to me testified to the importance of pacing, the importance of maintaining a dramatic arc in the screenplay, the danger of digressing into too many different things and losing control over the digressions after a point. I think that's what happened here. And I am happy at the same time that the movie's screenplay did not do any disservice to Philip K. Dick, the originator of these ideas.
So do you think ultimately it felt like a necessary revival to the franchise, or do you think it holds enough merit as a standalone film?
I don't think it was necessary in any way at all. I'm going to say that probably it was prompted by the idea of cashing in on a familiar name, a movie that again, did not do well at the box office initially, but has gained a cult reputation. And there is an assumed built-in audience for a movie like that. I don't think that it's done particularly well in American box offices. I understand it's done a little bit better elsewhere in the world for one reason or another. So, well, it'll make back its money probably in time. I don't think it's going to be looked back upon as fondly as the original. And then again, it couldn't be because time really has gone on. The original was startling to look at that time because it was so different than anything else going on in cinema. And the new, Blade Runner has the DNA of the original. It can't have the same startling impact.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express and the author of its I Hate Hollywood blog. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
We will take one more break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
Two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time once again for Ex Fabula Radio, part of Lake Effect Weekend every Saturday and Sunday on WUWM. Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney, the co-founder of Milwaukee's Ex Fabula, is here with us every weekend as well, bringing us stories from X Story Slams and events based on a theme, and this week, no exception.
Yes, you are correct. This week, we brought stories revolving around our Equal Access Project. So everyone deserves it, equal access, and at X Fabula, with the help of a generous grant from the Milwaukee Arts Board, we are offering a full season of opportunities for anyone with disabilities to pick up the microphone to tell their stories. We have a couple of events coming up. So our next Equal Access Project storytelling workshop will be held at Vision Forward on Holly Road on October 26th. And on October 30th, a workshop will be held at NAMI, which is a National Alliance on Mental Illness. So these workshops are absolutely free. And if you are interested or know anyone who might be interested in telling their stories, please go to exfabula.org for more information upon that.
And to your credit, in the past, Leah, and I am witness to this, that Exfabula has given the opportunity for anyone to pick up the microphone,
yes,
and tell their story. And even if they need assistance or whatever, anyone and everyone has a chance.
Yes, we are constantly working on our ways as our organization to create more access to everyone that wants to tell their story, because everyone deserves that opportunity for sure.
Yeah.
So we're going to start out today's show with a storyteller. Her name is Luann McGregor. And before we kind of roll into her story, I do want to tell you that Luann shared her story at an Equal Access workshop held at Vision Forward. And then she was vetted to tell a longer form story at one of our special events called The Spectacular. And I was there, and it was met with a standing ovation. And it's an incredibly powerful story. And I should mention also that the story is about abuse and how important it is to speak up about your experience.
My story is that when I was 16 years old, I met a disabled boy, and he had everything that I didn't. He had a job. He drove a car. I thought my social life would just take off because this guy drove a car. And I was real excited, and we started to date. And that's kind of unheard of in the disabled population. That doesn't happen too often. So I was real excited. And we'd go to dances, and we'd go out to eat, and we'd do everything together. So we dated until I was about 23, and then we got engaged. And I lived in an apartment, but he was still home with his mama. He lived just with his mother. It seemed like when we were dating, when I lived in the apartment, every time we'd go out, or every other time, his mother'd come along. And I thought, this is kind of strange. His mother's so overprotective, it drove me nuts. So I didn't know what to do, because I kind of liked the mother, but I knew that this was, you know, kind of strange, but I didn't want to separate from this car and this and this fact that I could have this good life with this man. Well, as I'm in the apartment, he started coming around, and he started becoming, you know, somewhat controlling. And I was young, and I wanted to do everything, and he was like, you got to clean the house. You got to keep your house clean. You got to do all these jobs. You got to do everything. And every time we went out, it was he'd come over, his mother would call 3-4 times in a 2-hour span. And it started driving me more and more crazy. But I didn't see through all that. I still was worried about that car. So as our life went on, he became more and more controlling. And one day, he came over and he took his finger and he ran it across my countertop. And he said, you better clean this. This is pretty dirty. And I thought, this is strange that he's worried about that. So I, you know, cleaned it. I didn't think anything of it. It got to the point that one day we were arguing, and I had this bird, and I really loved this bird, and it was in a cage, and he walked over to the bird cage, and he threw my bird from a third floor apartment down to the ground, killed my bird. And mother was there at the time, too. I had worked at a restaurant with him. That's where he worked, and I worked there, too. So I had to go to the restaurant, so I just forgave him about the bird. And so then more weeks went by, and his family was talking to me about they needed money to keep this restaurant going. And needless to say, prior to having the restaurant, I had given them $4,000 for their restaurant. So they were talking about needing more money. So I was really upset, but I thought, how can I get out of this? So they were going to take me to, my boyfriend was going to drive me to the bank to withdraw some money for them. I don't even remember what the money was going to be for. But so I go to the bank, and on the way to the bank, I think, I'm not going to give him any money. He doesn't need any money. You know, I've gave him all I can give him. So we get to the bank, we go to the drive-thru, and I say to him, I'm not going to give you any money. And he's real angry now, and he pulls out of the bank, and we get into, we're going about half a mile down the street, and he throws me out of the car. My wheelchair's still in the car, and he goes away. Well, a person across the street happened to see me lay there and came out and helped me. I said to myself, well, I got to do something. So when I went to the restaurant to work that day, the day when I finally went back, I thought, what can I do? So I thought of putting a note inside of this man at the restaurant's pocket saying I needed help. Could you call me? And it was a man that knew me. We were acquaintances. We had talked a lot at the restaurant. So when he called me, I said I was getting abused from my boyfriend, and I needed help. And he said, well, the next time he abuses you, call me, and I will come and help you. So it was like 2 days later, I got abused, and so I called him. And he came over, and he was like my knight in shining armor, and he took me to his family's house. There I stayed for 4 days. But I guess the reason I'm telling this story is that there's many people out there getting abused today, and they don't ask for help. And had I not asked for help, I would be in bad shape. But what happened after that is the man that came to help me, I ended up married 2 months later and was married for 30 years. So the moral of the story is he was my knight in shining armor, and I would like to be somebody's knight in shining armor and help them get out of the situation they're in. Because I'm telling you, there are somebody in this audience today getting abused that don't even realize it. And you've got to get out. Because once you get out, you see there's a better way for you to live. And I'd really like to help. Thank you.
And that was Luann McGregor's story that she originally told at our spectacular, which was themed Our Little Secret.
Very, very timely choice for
yes.
this week with the explosion of the hashtag MeToo in the past week or two.
Yeah.
A story of abuse and speaking up and being willing to help others is just, you know, good choice.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that this is a watershed moment, that people are speaking that it is. So I'm going to switch gears just for a couple seconds here and talk about upcoming events. Refugees Stories, held at the Hagerty Museum. It's going to be a curated story slam exploring the experiences of refugees living in Milwaukee. That's coming up. And also, if you have any desire to become a volunteer and help out Exfabula on October 30th, we are going to have a volunteer orientation, which is going to be held at Washington Park Library. So with that, let's jump right back into our second story. We're going to kind of switch the feel around a little bit here and tell a little bit more of a lighthearted story. This one is from Desiree Constantino, and she told a story at our do-over story slam. So let's listen to Desiree's story.
This is a story about my sexy doctor. We'll call him Sexy Dr. M. But you know, before we start, we should say I am a professional patient. Diagnosed with a juvenile rheumatoid arthritis when I was 8, I'm pretty used to doctors. I've been, you know, courting them for the last 30 years. And it just comes with the territory at this point. When I walk in, they know who I am, I know who they are, and we make jokes. And so kind of as a little icing on the cake that I finally got a sexy doctor. Now, Sexy and I have been together for about 13 years now. And yes, I say been together because it sounds like we're dating. And, you know, while my relationship has lasted thrice the times of my long-term dating relationships, I feel that we're much healthier and that we're able to communicate on a much, you know, even level than a lot of the men who see me in my underwear. So the story that I'm telling now or that I was thinking about today of do-overs is he's seen me through my crazy 20s, and we've been able to relate because, you know, only 10 years older than me, when I called him, or made the ER call him, at 6 o'clock on Halloween morning, because I had tripped off the curb and wouldn't let anybody cut off my dress or take off my tiara until he told them it was okay, we kind of bonded. And he, I think, really would like to take me out, you know, if it weren't for the wife and 3 kids and things like that. So, it's really hard to see when that light is, but one incident, shall I say, it's just an average procedure. I go see him. He tells me what I know but don't want to hear. And then we both go, okay. And generally, I find myself saying to him, you do realize that if you do this, then this could happen. And he says, yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. And so this last time, second to last time, he and I went out. He came up post-surgery, And there I was, and I was feeling good, still probably had a little bit of the, you know, surgery drugs in me, and everything had gone pretty well, and I was up and about, kind of dancing around in the hospital room. And he comes in just to say hi before he goes home, and he's, oh, he's so cute. Big, oh, big. You know, he could just flip me over his shoulder, which I'm sure he has, or in my dreams. And in my dreams, too, I am like Samantha in Sex and the City, where instead of just being the little patient, kind of crooked with lots of holes in her body, you know, I'm going, hello, doctor. So, again, he walks into the room, and I'm in my head kind of playing this whole kitty hee-hee-hee, and he's wearing these jeans, and he's just looking like a good old rugged boy. And so we're chatting, and, you know, and I'm giggling, and I'm giving him hell about, you know, taking his time to get up there and this and that. And so, you know, we do this thing until he leaves. And then I kind of look around at my sister, who's just staring at me with this look on her face. And I'm like, oh, I just love him. And she goes, you do realize that your gown was open the entire time that you were talking to him. And I still hadn't put on my underwear.
And that was Desiree Constantino's story from a do-over story slam. Ha, cha, cha, Des.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the question of have you ever had a sexy doctor? Yes, I have. I don't know about you, but yes, I have.
Just to recap, we have a whole bunch to talk about really quickly. At xfabula.org, you're going to find the following. All information about our Equal Access Project storytelling workshops on the 22nd and 30th. And then on the 30th as well, volunteer orientation. Please come help us out if you would like. And then, of course, the Refugee Story Slam at the Hagerty Museum. Holy cats.
That's
this is
lot.
Just within the next like few weeks. And, of course, we have another monthly Story Slam coming up in November.
Keeping you all busy.
Yep, our ears are nonstop listening. So,
well, thank you for taking some time to do this. And
yes.
We are here every weekend during Lake Effect Weekend, Saturday and Sunday afternoons. All information is at xfabula.org. And if you want to hear these stories again or share them, they are at wuwm.com. And we'll do this again next week.
Sounds good.
X-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for this week. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 4 o'clock, and keep listening because All Things Considered comes your way next.